I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. Welcome, Fadi.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where are you from initially?
I'm Lebanese. I was born in Beirut, but grew up in Jordan. My family is there, and my roots are mostly there.
How old were you when you moved to Jordan?
My father moved in the very early 60s, and we followed maybe two, three times. So I was about 3-4 years old.
What was the impetus for his moving to Jordan?
My father was in the airline business, but he was a political activist, and he was involved in a political party then in Lebanon that had tried to take over government. A familiar Middle East story. I'm sorry, there's the cliche there. And then eventually, because he was part of the leadership, he was sentenced to death.
You were so young at the time, but do you remember those days of being transported?
I have vivid memory of us crossing the border by car and my sister crying. They didn't want us to leave. So we had a scuffle with the customs people then, who ended up, because of my sister crying so much, ended up letting us go. So I have this this vision in my mind of us struggling at the border.
What did your father do in Jordan?
Well, my father comes from a relatively very poor family. My grandfather was a tram driver for the longest period of time, but he was a visionary in making sure that his 9 kids went to school. And my father was the eldest. So coming from such a background meant that you had to work harder. He left and came and studied here in NYU, by the way. He's an NYU grad from their aeronautics engineering school. He came here specifically to run away from politics. He had never seen an aircraft, and he chose aeronautics because he knew he didn't have to go to college locally because they didn't teach it, because he wanted to get away.
And did he take
a
ship here?
As a freshman, he took a ship, took him a month. And he spent 5 years here, worked. His first job was at American Airlines in Chicago. And then family pressure brought him back.
So your father makes his way back to the Middle East. Your father befriended the king and started Royal Jordanian Airlines.
Yeah.
How did he go from being a refugee to having this stature?
At that time, the politics of the region had King Hussein aligned with certain groups, and my father's group seemed to have been aligned with him at that time. Mm-hmm. And thus, when he ended up in Jordan as a political refugee, it was a natural connection. And thus, being an aeronautics engineer, and maybe one of the first 2 or 3 aeronautics engineer in the Arab world then, so what else was he going to do? And he had helped start an airline with a friend of his in Lebanon before that. So aeronautics engineer, entrepreneur, Jordan, small country, needed an airline. And there you go.
Now, you were watching this as you were growing up. Did you have any ambitions to follow him in the airline business? Or what were your thoughts as far as a career was concerned?
You know, my memory is vague on this because maybe I didn't have any ambitions as such. I was a hyperactive kid. So my memory of myself was running around all the time, doing naughty and crazy things that scared the heck out of my mom. But I didn't think of what was I going to do in life, really. I didn't think long term. But I watched him. I watched him. I watched his political activism. He still is an incredible role model. The people he connected with were extremely interesting. So we lived a fascinating life, if you want.
And you went back to Lebanon to study at the American school there.
Yes, I I'm surprised you got that. But in 1967, as you know, there was the Arab-Israeli War. We used to go to Beirut every summer for vacation out of Jordan. So, and that summer, June of 67, the war broke out. We were in Beirut vacationing. We didn't come back. So I ended up spending 3 years in boarding school in Beirut. I was actually it didn't work out for me in boarding school, so they basically kicked me out, and I went back to the family.
Well, you went to boarding school as you were 10 years old.
I was a baby.
Time. Right.
Oh, my God. I still say that to myself. Independent. Believe it or not, I used to get something called gate pass, a gate pass, which means it allows me to go out of school during weekends. And at 10 years old, I would take the bus and go to my grandparents' house, which is about a 45-minute, an hour drive. So I would go to the bus station, change buses. I still remember that and say, I would never let my kids even walk in the street nowadays. Mm-hmm. But I did that. It shaped part of my character.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 when Fadi was 22 years old, and Aramex was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. You ultimately made your way to the United States, to George Washington University,
yes,
for college. Yeah. What were your first impressions of the United States?
Well, I carried a heck of a lot of responsibility then because I came to the U.S. with my mom and my baby sister who had a learning disability. I was the only one driving then, so my sister went to a children's hospital, a special education program in D.C. So I had to basically wake up very early in the morning and drive her to school every single day for a full year while being a freshman and part of the swim team at GW. And my impression was the ease at 18 years. It's easy for a teenager to actually make his way around in the U.S. Most of the American students at that time were working to either support themselves or their tuition or their living. In the Middle East, unfortunately, that's unheard of. Our families provide for us until we get married and find a job. So that was fascinating for me. I was embarrassed sometimes to say that I didn't work. It was embarrassing. Your father pays for your tuition? Was like, wow. That was a standard question at that time. And it made me feel uncomfortable eventually, so I stopped talking about it.
You talk about the ease. Are you talking about even in the mundane life, like
ease,
the roads?
Like getting a driver's license. It took me nothing, you know. You did your eye exam and then you sit behind the computer, and the driving test was cakewalk, easy.
So it's ironic you say that, because we Americans do not think the DMV is easy. We think it's a logistical nightmare.
You guys need to see what happens in the rest of the world and to appreciate of what your DMV is. And then eventually renewal was via mail. That's unheard of anywhere in the world today.
It's the first time we've heard of the DMV being an example of efficiency.
Right. Well, life is, things are relative. So you need to see what happens somewhere else to appreciate what you have.
What about negative impressions of the United States when you were first here?
Negative impressions in my early days was the and I'm sorry to say that, is the ignorance of world affairs and specifically of the Middle East. It was very frustrating for me, but fantastically, probably if you want to ask me what was the single most important thing that I learned in the U.S. is how to understand the causes that I care for in the Middle East and know how to argue them in the U.S. I used to think that it was a natural. We used to think that we have a just cause, and just causes sell themselves. But the reality, nothing sells itself unless you're able to argue it and argue it well and know your facts very well. So from the early days, it was also my first exposure to Jews. It was my first exposure to an argument on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I basically had to understand democracy, understand argument, understand debate well, and knowing how to present yourself was such an essential. Again, coming from a political family, I automatically became a political activist here with the Arab Students Union, and there was, at that time it was so heated, and I looked a bit, I had a big beard and my hair was long, and I looked like a bit of a revolutionary.
Here you were in a very politicized, heated environment. What about your academic life? What did you focus on?
I started, my first year was, I went into engineering school, and then I failed miserably. I had an F in in a physics class. It didn't work out for me with engineering. I automatically changed into political science. I think it's also a very important step for me because in political science, I also got to understand the habit of reading. Mm. And that helped me a lot in my entrepreneurial life.
So you leave George Washington, you graduate, and you start Aramex out of college by accident. You met your co-founder, Bill Kingston,
yes,
in the United States.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, Bill knew my dad. So I stumbled into him. I think we were at the Paris Air Show. FedEx was just happening in the U.S. back then. He said, this is an interesting business. Maybe we should do something in the Middle East. Cool. Why not? I am ready. And then he arranged that I go to see the FedEx hub in Memphis. And there was a company called Purelator Courier then in the U.S. Most people don't remember it now, but it used to be bigger than FedEx, believe it or not. Obviously, these were massive for me. FedEx, aircrafts, Middle East does not fit into that. Went back to Amman to start the business.
Here you are doing all this research, going yes. from courier company to courier right. company in the United States.
Yes.
But you're a maverick. You seemed a little unreliable and heated.
I still am.
Why would Bill trust you to start this business in the Middle East?
Well, it's not a question of trust. He was basically talking to my father, not to me. A logical man would never get into this business because it's a very, very difficult business to get into because you're effectively having to build a global network from day one. I mean, that's the nature of the beast.
Right. What were the first steps that you took to build Aramex?
Well, the first steps that we took is after I looked at the study that Bill had done, we threw it in the garbage, obviously, because it was done by, an American company who tapped into research and information about the region, which still doesn't exist today. Forget about that. Threw that in the garbage, and we started researching how do you register a company. And at that time, post offices would not allow anybody to get in because they thought we were their competitors, and this was a monopolistic situation for them. The law did not allow for courier companies, but DHL and ourselves were at the forefront of actually fighting for deregulation and allowing people like us to establish the mail delivery business. And then we also stumbled simultaneously onto the fact that a lot of the American companies then, FedEx, UPS, Burlington, Purelator, Airborne Express, gave their packages to deliver in the Middle East. They gave them to competitors like DHL and TNT at that time. So click to us. This is where the niche is. You establish an independent network in the region to deliver packages for these guys who are not interested to be in the Middle East at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai. We'll hear more from Fadi coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. So the way you got in the door was by being a supporter of the FedExes in the Middle East. And you weren't their competitor at the time. You were seen as a partner of theirs.
This was our selling point. We said, we're independent. We'll build a network for you. We will customize. Even the word customization was not there yet. But we actually delivered for every single competitor. Aramex was their single source of delivery. They all gave us their packages in the Middle East, so they had one address in the Middle East, even though they hated each other here. We were able to answer a phone for FedEx. We had an Airborne phone, and we had an Emery phone and a Purelator phone, and we delivered on their paperwork. The FedEx brand was there through me. So for them, it was a natural. They didn't have to do anything. We had an office here in New York, and all FedEx needed to do, or Airborne, was to deliver at our JFK office, which still exists today. And from there, we took it all the way. So they didn't have to think of customs, procedures, anything. Just give it to me there, and we'll take it. And eventually, we opened an office in New York, in Paris, London, and in Hong Kong and in Singapore to do exactly the same thing for other courier companies in other parts of the world so that nobody had to think about shipping into the Middle East because it was a bit complicated. Where's the Middle East? We didn't know. The geography was not even known then.
So you were this, you were the wholesaler and you were the courier to these couriers.
Absolutely. We were the courier of couriers, if you want, to the Middle East. So we were a known brand to the industry.
Did you know you wanted to branch out on your own after servicing FedEx and these other couriers, learning on their dime?
Yes.
At what point did you say, you know what, I want to eventually compete with these guys?
Yeah, well, I would have loved to stay doing their stuff because it was easy stuff. I didn't have to have retail operations or anything. But the reality of the matter is we knew that they will eventually go global. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Europe. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Asia. So the minute they say they're global, they, it means the Middle East. So they can do it two ways in the Middle East, either acquire us or go set up their own operation. We've had some discussions with some of them about acquisitions, but we never came to a conclusion, luckily, because the value of the company today and every day that we refused any offer increased.
What was the delta between FedEx and Airborne Express's perception of you as a reliable company in the Middle East to do their work and the reality of what you were? Like, what level of improvisation had to happen?
Oh, plenty of improvisation. So we built the business on the backs of our clients. Meaning, you know, I learned the business from Federal Express and Airborne Express. I mean, I understood my limitations very well, and I understood their power so well. And I took advantage of it to the hilt. Meaning, every time I had the chance to meet, learn, send people from my company to get trained by these guys, we did. And we did that by pushing them very hard to take our kids to get trained by them. And that's how we learned the business. I know everything that I need to know about this industry today because of FedEx and Airborne Express. They taught us the business and they paid us for it. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you need to know is their ignorance in the early days of the region, and I can say that now, led me to do things that they didn't know. Meaning, I would have claimed that I had a full network. That was not a lie, but that was not the full truth either. So meaning I always had somebody somewhere to deliver a package for me, but it didn't mean it was my employee. I always found someone, a taxi driver here or a travel agent there, and I would say, you know, call him and say, here's an airway bill coming to you on this airline. Please go to customs and clear it and deliver it. And say you're from Aramex. Mm. Because the reality of the matter is, as all startups are, and especially in the Middle East, we were undercapitalized. We were not sure we were going to make it. And so you needed to improvise. I was regularly taking a flight from Amman, our hub then, to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and have packages with me.
You were the delivery boy.
I was the delivery boy. I would check into a hotel, literally check into a hotel, wake up very early next morning, grab a cab, tell him I have these 10 addresses. I would go and deliver every package to these people and go back in the afternoon and do my business meetings so that I can try to get my license. So, but nobody knew that then. Mm-hmm. Nobody, I would knock on these doors and say, I have this package. But I was the founder of this company delivering those packages. And that's how I learned the business.
This was in the early 1980s. If I had told you then that you would be a billion-dollar company in 2010, would you have been surprised? Or
I would have been absolutely surprised. Our market cap when we were public on NASDAQ in 1997 never exceeded $70 million. Yeah, small micro cap. $1 billion, my God, you know, at the height of this company, when we went public on the Dubai Stock Exchange, we actually hit $2 billion. And so, wow. I mean, this is incredible for us.
You mentioned FedEx. The founder of FedEx is Fred Smith.
Yes.
Did you meet him?
I met Fred Smith, and I know exactly how I met him. So I went to every single conference on the industry that could happen during those days. I was still in my 20s. So Fred Smith was a keynote speaker at one of those conferences. And I said, I have to meet this man. So right before he finished, I waited at the door. And I'm a shy man in general. And before people attacked, I came to him and said, you know, I am so-and-so, and I have this small company. And then he was nice. He said, yes, nice to meet you. And from then on, I kept following him, believe it or not. Wherever he was a keynote speaker, I would follow Fred Smith, and I would continue to go back and introduce myself and say, remember me? I came to see you once. So, he's without him doing it directly, he was a mentor.
Now, FedEx is one of the world's largest airlines.
Right.
At what point did you start to build an airline business behind Aramex?
We were never an airline. We're still not an airline. We are a non-asset-based company, and we have taken a decision very early on to be a non-asset-based company. One, because we didn't have the capital. Number two, because we knew it can be done without necessarily building an airline or building assets. It is about the customer experience, and that's where we focused.
Do you think if you had more access to capital in the Middle East that you might be a different company? Because if capital had been easier for you, you might have started an airline and been an asset-rich company.
Right, and luckily not. And that's one thing that I would never, if you tell me what would you do differently, I would tell you I would certainly not look for more capital, because the biggest learning experience for us is having to do things on the very cheap, and that created an incredible amount of innovation and creativity inside the organization. We conserved. We were entrepreneurs on one side, but we understood the value of the dollar, and that is what makes us successful today.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Was there ever a turning point in the company? I mean, here you were really just scotch taping things together and improvising your way through building this company. At what point did you say, wow, you know what, we're becoming an institution?
Well, I think by the time Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1990, we had reached a point of having relative stability in the network in the Middle East. Nothing fantastic, nothing fancy, but we had a nice brand with the industry. And then the war comes, and then all hell breaks loose. Kuwait is invaded and occupied. Saudi Arabia airspace was closed. 500,000 American troops on Saudi soil. Airspace in Jordan was closed. We were shut down. And then we had to respond to that crisis internally in the company and manage resources. We had employees in Kuwait then that came driving to Jordan. FedEx withdrew then. They had some offices in the region, by the way, and said, we're shutting down. You deliver everything for us. So we felt a sense of responsibility, and we felt that even with that crisis, we didn't lay off any people then still, if you want, and we were able to scrap and manage and make sure that the company was intact, even though it was an existential issue. But we thought in crisis, when we responded and we responded together, we said, this is a company that is here to stay. As the war ended, clients appreciated this massively. And from there on, we were the company that has stayed. A lot of banks relied on us at that time. Even, you know, I remember the CEO of the Arab Bank, which is one of the largest banks, the largest bank in Jordan, calling me in the middle of the war and telling me, Fadi, we have these magnetic tapes that we need to secure, and I need them out of this country, and I need you to every single day take these magnetic tapes and take them to a country that is more secure. That was a turning point for us, and that was a turning point for our brand in the region. And from there on, we started building the business from the grassroots up.
By the way, you were married to your business. You were growing the company. What was going on in your personal life at the time?
I was married to the business, and I was married to Rula, who is my wife. We're separated now, but she's still my wife and still a very good friend of mine. And the mother of my two sons. It's a strain on family life.
You're on a plane more than 50% of your time. Do you find that enervating or energizing?
I unfortunately am. How shall I put that? I am an addict of traveling now. Which is crazy, because I feel if I spend more than a week in one place, I am stuck. And one thing I didn't want to do, like my father, was to have that constant travel. But I guess that's one habit I inherited from him. And I'm a curious person. I became much more curious as I grow and realize how little I know, and my drive to knowledge is insatiable. So I am constantly traveling. I'm constantly meeting people. I'm constantly doing things. I mean, that's my life today, and I wouldn't have any other way. I love it. I absolutely love it.
You seem to have a lot of energy. You swim every day, or you try to.
Yeah, that's something I will never compromise on. I've been swimming since as long as I remember.
What does it do for you?
It's the ultimate meditation. So people talk about, you know, yoga and breathing exercises. Swimming is the ultimate breathing exercise, because that's all you're doing. And it just clears my mind. It gives me the energy to go on. I'm disciplined in that. I'm disciplined in my food. I'm disciplined in my work. I'm disciplined in my exercise. Even though I am rebellious and here and there, but when it comes to something which I feel is a responsibility towards myself, towards my family, towards what I do, I am extremely disciplined. I have this sense of responsibility which drives me crazy sometimes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. In 1997, you decided to go public on an American stock exchange, the NASDAQ. What was the impetus for that?
We ended up wanting to do a private placement in the region to raise money from Arab capital, if you want. But we failed. We failed miserably because we were a non-asset-based company. At that time, people would ask me, do you own buildings? Do you own aircrafts? What do you own? I said, you know, I don't own anything. We own the client experience. I'm in the package delivery business. I do it well. That's all I own. I have a network. I have strategic alliances. No, we don't own anything. We barely own our cars. So for them, you know, why would you want to value? At that time, I think we were valuing the company at around $30 or $35 million in a private placement. So where's the value then? So we failed. So Bill looks at me and says, you know what, Fadi? We're going to go to NASDAQ. And that scared the heck out of me. I said, Bill, what do you mean NASDAQ? NASDAQ, this company is owned by me and you. Nobody looks at our numbers. We barely audit our numbers. We audit them, but we barely audit them. Legally, we're like 500 different companies. There's no one structure. He said, it can be done. That was August 1996. And luckily, Bill, his biggest gift to us, he also convinced Airborne Express around the same time to give us $2 million for 9% of the company. For the first time, after talking to Airborne for 13 years, they said, okay, here's $2 million. So the biggest check I had ever seen in my life kept me sleeping for quite some time, because I had, you know, life for an entrepreneur was managing cash flow. Other than making sure packages get delivered, I needed to every morning spend 2 hours with my chief financial officer juggling our payments, because we had such a terrible reputation for being such late payers. But that's life when you're scrapping to run a business. In any case, so Airborne buys 9% for $2 million. And then we say NASDAQ. All by January of 1997, we were on the exchange. So that was miraculous. I can't tell you. And I did the roadshow with Bill. We were only raising $7 million, believe it or not. This was a micro. 2 million of those went to the lawyers and to the banks. We were left with $5 million. And that was the first check that I ever took myself personally as an owner from the green shoe. So there was, you know, an oversubscription, and we ended up making, I don't know, $300,000-$400,000 extra. If you tell me what was the turning point, yes, originally what happened in the Iraq war, Iraq-Kuwait war, the reality of the matter, the biggest turning point in our life was us going on NASDAQ, because that made us a legitimate global brand in the eyes of our clients in the Middle East. Nobody had ever done it before. And the respect we got from banks, from clients, from people walking down the street who had heard about this story, until today, we're still called as Aramex, the company that was the first to go public on NASDAQ. It is a stamp on our forehead, and we're proud of it. It's a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story, especially because you have achieved such success in such an unlikely region. What needs to change?
I'll tell you what needs to change. It needs to have a government system that has a loose safety net. In the Gulf, where there's oil money, there's a huge safety net. The citizen does not feel the urge to innovate or to create or to create his own business, because our education system starts from day one telling us that the government is going to take care of us. We are not taught the skills that entrepreneurs need to be taught. We are not told that private enterprise is legitimate. Even though the Prophet Muhammad was an entrepreneur, and he was a traveler in trade, which means he had to deal with people, and the owner of the business was a woman, his eventual future wife. We don't teach our kids, because the state is predominant in our life. So we need to change our education system. We need to legitimize and say that entrepreneurship, private enterprise, not working for government is okay, is actually good for you. Having venture capital, angel investors bet on ideas and not bet on hard assets. We love building buildings, but I don't see as many people believing in ideas and believing in entrepreneurs and thus believing in people. But it is not as arid as people think it is. The Arab world is changing very quickly. There is a huge reservoir of entrepreneurs. I'm an angel investor, as you know. I can't tell you the amount of people that come to me on a daily basis asking, showing me their business plans and asking me for either help or advice or capital.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Jessica Harris, this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers actually who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, "What about me?" You know, they manage, they go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun, but, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, "Oh, we're so glad you're doing this. It's my husband's she's so happy," and all that. And she said, "There used to be a store in Washington that closed." And I said, "Oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that?" She said, "Oh, it was called the Short Men Shop." And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this, and they go, "Oh, really? Yeah, that sounds interesting. You know, I do okay." And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, "Hey, you gonna do polo shirts?"
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys department.
What is a tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the money, the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway, the subway signs, are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched in February 2012.
Oh, yeah, we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that you're, you know, I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. But I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays, and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire, you know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band there. He can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's just he's a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and turned it down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible, incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day, going, oh, yeah, I got the show. It's The Sopranos. I remember vividly thinking to myself, wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type. Because I thought it was, I had no idea. I mean, that's, so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. And it kind of, you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And we're, everyone's working for nothing in a, conditions that are like, you know, almost tawdry. And you sort of do it and get it on and it works. And it just, I knew, and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just, I thought, that's not going to happen again. So, you know what, let me just put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought there was no way for both of us to have a really the careers that you need to have in the theater. Because you have to give 110% of the theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant. And we had an incredible interview that where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, you know, it was work, so we were nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving. But he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and, you know, so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. You know, we were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer, too. So she's got to sort of blaze that trail, too, and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia.
I did. And
focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who had been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah. It's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows. And has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. You know, there's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving in the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell-bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell-bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell-bottoms anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it vividly as, you know, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell-bottoms is my rosebud. You know what I mean? So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, nine years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I have this mustard pair of, like, you know, sort of pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. You know, other 5-year-olds are not saying that. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you're gay, but I mean, it was, so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hid it, and like lots of people did, and came out when I was 21, and everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, you know, from the age of 5. How about your parents?
My mother was really, you know, she dressed beautifully. You know, she knew that girl, you know, she taught at a girls' school and she knew girls were watching. So she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, you know, weeks and weeks on times. She always looked put together and always managed to, you know, look great on without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. It didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up. And so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and start this. And it's like this that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with the retail. And I told her, I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They are starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands, and you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
Hmm. What bank?
M&T Bank, mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I got started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan and I was like, we're off. Hmm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we have a proven concept and sort of real growth. And people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. When you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur. Sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it, and everyone's going to live. And it, you know what I mean? When you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them. All of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, ooh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player. And she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit, the weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going, ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and, like, be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to, like, look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and, oh, so interested in this humanities class and, wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home, and it was all in our house. Like, one day, a truck came and delivered all these boxes, and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, we just, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like, It's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was. And I was like, there he is. He looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sideman, and Sideman being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, I sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sideman, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of here are these things, and these sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.